There we are. I think we're recording. Okay, great. Well, welcome everyone. Happy New Year. Welcome to a new series. And how long will this go on for? Well, as long as I can make it last, really, as long as I can stretch it out. Partly because I enjoy this sort of topic myself, but also because I hope there'll be so much sort of interaction and comments as we go along. And I haven't got it all prepared yet, but I've got a rough idea of what we want to cover. Some of it might be familiar to you. I'm not pretending everything in this is new, but I've started to put it together in a new way, and basically with you in mind, really, to trial this out in this particular format. So we called it Listening to the Jewish Jesus, which means it's part of what is a very well accepted idea now that Jesus was Jewish. In fact, I'd even go as far as to say is Jewish. He still is. But when he was here on earth, he acted, lived, spoke as a Jew to other Jews. And therefore, we're going to focus in on that, because if there's one thing that, to me, highlights his Jewishness, is whenever he opened his mouth and spoke. And that's almost my other title for this. He opened his mouth and spoke. And the reason for that is I want you to start to look things up as soon as possible. Have a look at Matthew 5 and verse 2, which of course you'll realize is the beginning of a major teaching section. Matthew 5, verse 2. Now, if you've got a version like mine, the NIV, it will just say something like, "He began to teach them, saying." But if you've got an older version, it will probably say something a bit different. Do we have any other translations for Matthew 5:2 other than the sort of standard, "He began to teach them, saying"? Anyone got anything else?
This is what
he opened his mouth. Sorry.
You've got him, anything more than just he opened his mouth?
And taught them, saying.
He opened his mouth and taught them, saying. Yeah. Anybody else? Pat, you've got your hand up, so but now you're muted, so.
I've got one new man, but it says the same as in Mary's. Then opening his mouth, he taught them saying.
Yeah, you can change the sort of tense or feel of it, but in those other cases, you've got three verbs, haven't you? Opened, taught,
Taught
saying.
saying,
All
yeah.
seems a bit superfluous. In English, we'd never say anything like that. That's why these modern versions tend to tidy it up a little bit and becomes just, "He began to teach them, saying." But that's a very Hebraic expression in its own way. The repeated number of verbs, which is meant to sort of emphasize something. And I checked it out, and it is in the Greek. So the Greek is trying to reflect what I believe would be what actually the Hebrew would be saying, because Hebrews don't mind verbs. They quite like them, and they tend to dominate. So if you're a Hebrew reader, or indeed listener to this, if you heard something as sort of overblown as opened his mouth and taught them saying, you'd be quite happy with that, because it'd be used to sort of emphasize to you that this is important, this is worth listening to, this isn't just somebody saying something. Okay, so it's a Hebraic phrase which is indicating to us that we're into the whole Hebraic world, if you like. Let me illustrate that further. It's all part of introduction, really. And that's if you go to Genesis 24, 63, back in Genesis 24, verse 63. Now, this is back in the story of Isaac. And there he is meditating in the fields. If you've got a version that you think is sort of fitting this and giving us lots of verbs, would you like to tell us what it says in your version of Genesis 24, 63? Unmute and say it.
So the verbs I got is meditate.
Well, okay, he's meditating, yeah, and then what happened?
lifting his eyes, looking, and suddenly he saw camels coming.
Okay, well, it's the actual the verbs to do with him looking. Okay, so you might have got something like he lifted up his eyes and saw, and behold.
Yes.
Okay, so again, there's a multiplicity of verbs there. In fact, if you go back, I think it's, I got me back one verse or forward. The same thing is said about Rebecca. So, you know, there's Isaac in the fields. It doesn't mean he was looking down and so on, but he looked up and saw is a way of expressing something significant. This is a key moment in Isaac's life, really, and therefore it's a key moment in the whole Genesis narrative. Because what actually did he see when he lifted up his eyes and saw? Yeah, he saw a lot of camels, but that wasn't what delighted him. If you read carefully, what did he see? He saw Rebecca.
Rebecca, yeah.
Yeah, his bride-to-be was coming up, and then she lifted up her eyes and also saw him. This is a big moment in the whole story and in their lives. You know, that sort of eyes meeting, not quite across a crowded room, but across a sort of dusty desert and a group of camels, maybe even love at first sight and so on. Now, that's, again, it's just to illustrate that this sort of thing occurs a lot within Hebrew. It's natural there within Genesis. But have a look in Luke 16, 23. And in Luke 16, 23, which obviously is back to Jesus and the story that he's telling, this is the story about a rich man and a beggar called Lazarus. And you know that they both died and, shall we say, went their separate ways. And we don't mean to worry too much about all the rest of that. But there's a point there in the middle of that story. And don't forget, this would be Jesus actually speaking it, saying it, where he also uses the phrase looked up and saw. He says, at one point, the rich man looked up and saw Abraham with Lazarus by his side. So that's Luke 16, 23. And again, that sort of overuse of verbs is something that we wouldn't normally deal with and have. But it does suggest that this is Hebraic storytelling and going on in Jesus. So when we listen to the Jewish Jesus, what sort of things are we going to actually find ourselves hearing? Well, there'll be lots of what we call idioms or colloquialisms. An idiom, if you're not familiar with that, is an expression which is very common in one language, but absolutely makes no sense if you just translate it literally. It only has a meaning really within the culture in which it's spoken or with those who are native speakers. So we have lots of idioms, every language does. We might say it's raining cats and dogs, but if you translated that word for word into another language, it caused a lot of confusion about what's actually happening to your pets. All sorts of different phrases like that. So we're going to meet times when Jesus is speaking so Hebraically, using idioms and colloquialisms, that if we are to fully understand what he's saying, we need to dig below that. Sometimes the translations help, sometimes they don't, because they're just trying to translate what's in the Greek, and the Greek is still portraying something of this Hebrew nature, so we get something that doesn't immediately make sense to us. So that'd be one whole series of different things we'll look at. And then there's many times when Jesus refers to the scriptures, his own scriptures, of course, the Tanakh, we call the Old Testament. And I don't just mean times when it's very clear that he's quoting something and we all know what it is, we can look it up and so on. But there are many times when it's much more obscure. And I know I've done some of these sometime in the past, but there's new people joining us all the time. And these are occasions when a Jewish listener of the time would fully pick up all the little hints and clues and allusions that Jesus is using when he refers to the Old Testament. Because, of course, they knew it thoroughly, because they'd learnt it from an early age. They committed it to memory. So that's something that they would pick up easily, and we don't. And sometimes our footnotes or study guide doesn't actually help us. So we'll be finding quite a few of those. And then there's also lots of different aspects of things in first century Judaism with which we're not automatically familiar. It was a very religious world with its own culture, so different from ours. So we might have to come to terms with that. So we won't be covering every single word that Jesus spoke. That's obviously not possible, really, but it's also not necessary, because it doesn't mean that everything that Jesus said has got something that like that that has to be unpacked. Not everything is that mysterious or that cryptic. So we're just going to focus on the places where some kind of explanation is needed. And the idea then is that hopefully in the future, when you read the Gospels, some of these little sort of mysterious elements will make more sense to you, and so on. So he opened his mouth and spoke as a Jew to Jews, and we've got to try and listen as, well, Westerners to this Jewish Jesus. So that's by way of introduction as to what it's about and what's coming up. Does anyone want to make any comments before we go into the first sort of topic for tonight? We might do two or three topics, we'll see how time goes. Does anyone want to comment on what I've said? I assume you've understood it well enough, but you might want to ask something. So,
Paul, do we?
Oops. Is that Eleanor?
Yeah.
Oh, you muted Eleanor if you're trying to speak. No, okay. Oh, Jackie's got a hand up.
Jackie Curran?
Yeah, hi, Jackie.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think this is particularly helpful, because when you've visited these before and when I've studied some of these before, like idioms and other like hints and remes and sort of, you know, quoting part of a verse and we don't know the full story behind it. I just found that it really opened up the scriptures. And, so
yeah, and that's people, why I will keep revisiting it, because I say there's always new people coming along. Mm-hmm. I always find a little bit more myself. You know, you get a little bit here, a little bit there. So I've actually taken what I already got and added more to it and sort of repackaging it. So mm-hmm. yeah, if you're not familiar with this, then it should be a very sort of exciting adventure. If you're fairly familiar with it, then it will reinforce things, and also you will get some new things along the way, I'm sure.
Yep.
But thanks for that encouragement. But yeah, I did particularly do an evening or two on this before. Anybody else want to make a comment at this stage before we?
Well, I think I'm unmuted now, am I?
Yes, that's it. Hi. Your camera's gone, but oh no. Eleanor, you're now muted and dark.
Elaine had her hand up.
Okay. Thank you for helping out, because I can't see everybody on the screen. Elaine, can you unmute? Thank you.
Yes. Just wondering, because also the background, the sort of Jesus's education, if you like.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he's learning at a young age, being in the temple, all of that sort of thing, and the company he was keeping. So presumably his own like educational and social interaction at a young age would obviously have had a huge impact.
Yeah, indeed, because he grew up as a Jew amongst Jew. You're quite right, he would have gone through the same system. And just because he was the Son of God, it didn't mean that he either didn't need to, or that he was just sort of beamed down at some point. He was born a Jew and raised a Jew and so on. So, yeah. And so that also means that he would be aware of what others had particularly gone through. Mm. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know whether Eleanor's still trying to get through to us, but she keeps coming and going and disappearing. But anyway, let me move on to the first topic then, because I think before we really focus in on things that Jesus said and particular contexts and that, we need the background of what it meant at the time for someone to be a rabbi and others to be a disciple. And they're two very key things within the religious culture of the time. that we've sort of got a bit of an idea of, but it's not part of our experience in the same way. And the whole rabbi-disciple relationship is so dominant to the Gospels that we need to get some kind of understanding of this. So Jesus was addressed as a rabbi time and time again. Somebody says there's about 40. I haven't counted them myself. And not just by people who eventually were his main disciples, but by all sorts of different people at different times. So when he was referred to as rabbi, you tell me what you think was being expressed then, or what was really being meant by that. What do you understand at this stage by someone being like Jesus being referred to as rabbi?
Teacher.
Just teacher, okay. Anything else?
Teacher, was he regarded as a knowledgeable person of the scriptures?
Okay.
Scriptures.
Yeah. Perhaps hand up again.
Is it he knew the Torah?
Yeah, okay.
A teacher with authority.
Okay. You're all using the word teacher, which of course is right up to a point. But does the word actually mean teacher, do you think? Is that a proper translation?
Would leader come into it?
Not so much at this time, really, no. Anyone know?
Is it not just a term of respect for someone older and wiser?
Well, that's the first point to make, is that this was not a title. There's nothing official about it. Later, and by later I mean after AD 70, when, as you know, the temple was destroyed and Jerusalem was destroyed, and Judaism had to redefine itself and became actually what we call more rabbinic Judaism. But it was only from AD 70 onwards that the title rabbi acquired a particular significance in which people were then sort of set apart. And that's maybe then where the idea of leader comes from as well, because they would lead a synagogue or a congregation. And therefore they did teach as well. And that's the point in which there was a ceremony. And I think there was the act of laying on of hands. There was something called semichah, if I've pronounced it right. But that was still to come. So at the time when Jesus was teaching, there weren't any qualifications as such. There was no official recognition. It was a courteous title for someone who was accepted as such. And I usually give the illustration that when I was a teacher at school, everybody was expected to, and usually did, call me sir. But that, again, was just a courtesy title. I couldn't put sir in front of my name. There's no capital S involved. I had not received a knighthood or anything as nice as that. It was just a respectful way of acknowledging the relationship and the authority between the two. So it's at that sort of level. I still wanted to know what this word actually means, though, and I'll tell you in a minute. But Lynn, you want to say something now?
Reading Matthew the other day, noticing it was saying very much, woe to you scribes and Pharisees.
Yeah.
The scribes then had, were those that, what? Who were the scribes that they should be?
They were people that had learned to write.
Sorry?
There were people that had learned to write.
And they taught. Was there an element of them teaching?
Well, they're probably teachers as well. Not every teacher, I think, was a scribe. Right. I'm not even sure every scribe was a teacher. There would certainly be an overlap. And they all tend to be within the world of the Pharisees. But a person was called a scribe because he could write. And not everybody could. And in fact, really, they didn't even sort of read very much. They did it by all the stuff. But if you needed a document written, you went to someone who actually could know how to do it properly.
I was sorry, it might not be the right time to ask. I was curious to know why they were first in the list.
Oh, I see. I had no idea. I don't know whether
they were just copying it out. Why were they woe to them?
The point about them, and it's the same with Pharisees generally, is that because they could do this special thing, they actually thought rather highly of themselves.
Oh.
You know, we are special people. We can do this. Right. You've got to come to us. So I'm afraid it was the usual sort of thing that Jesus was against in that way. And in fact, they were just proud about their ability to know and understand the law and to write it out and other things like that.
Thank you.
Is anyone going to tell me what the word rabbi really means?
He's addressed as master, isn't he, sometimes?
Master comes in as well, yeah. Anita's trying to come in with something here. Don't forget to unmute.
I think Christine.
And John Rogers wants to speak.
Okay, well, I can see lots of people trying to. Can my co-host please help here?
Oh, Christ, forget it. I always hear that, forget it. No, I've been here.
Does anyone want to say what they think rabbi actually means?
I thought it meant master.
Well, again, it can be used by that. I'm going for a more pinpoint sort of, it comes from a word meaning a word rav, and but and ver are pretty much the same. So if you know what the word rav means, well, it means great.
Great one.
So yes, rabbi is a way of saying my great one. And in that sense, it could be anybody that you look up to, anybody that you acknowledge as being someone that you can benefit from or gain from. But of course, it applied mainly to those who were involved in the Torah and therefore could help you there. So if you want a more expanded sort of expression for what rabbi is really saying, it is saying a mixture of master, teacher, person of great learning, someone I look up to with respect for that purpose, if you like. Okay, we've got there. So Jesus got this regular popular term of esteem from mainly the crowds around him and so on. Not everybody would want to acknowledge him in that sort of way, but mostly the crowds did. But let me point you to a very well-known bit. If you look up John chapter 3, verse 2, John 3, verse 2, and I'm sure you know enough of this chapter to know who we're referring to here, but one of Israel's great teachers himself, who came to Jesus, addresses him as rabbi. So in John chapter 3, verse 2, this is Nicodemus, of course, and he starts off the whole conversation by calling him rabbi, again, out of courtesy and so on. And then he adds, I think, a very important statement, which we will certainly look at another time, probably not tonight, though. We know you are a teacher who has come from God. Okay, so that's the basis on which he is recognizing him as a rabbi. We know, and I assume the we, it's not really, I don't think he's being posh here and calling himself we. He probably means his disciples as well. In fact, it's very likely that Nicodemus turned up with some of his disciples and met with Jesus and some of his disciples. You know, it wasn't just a sort of one-to-one get together, but so he's probably speaking on behalf of his own disciples here, or those that, you know, are part of what he's doing as Israel's teacher. So it was a recognition again of something about him, and in this case something very important about Jesus. He is a teacher who has come from God, which a lot of people recognized, a lot of people either didn't or didn't want to. So we're now going to think about the word disciple, but is there any other comments on what I've said so far just about rabbi? And we've got this, there's only two or three main points in all that. But,
I understood before they were known as rabbis, they're known as sages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think people were all known as sages. And that again just means, I think, someone who is wise on something, just like we might use the word. So I think it's a common term that was used. But I don't see anywhere in the Gospels, unless I'm not remembering properly, where Jesus was referred to as a sage. He was always referred to using this term. But yeah. So anyone who was a rabbi was, or would have, disciples, even if only a handful, though some might have a lot more. And I'm sure you know from Steve's writings and other places that the Hebrew word Talmid is what's behind this. But the relationship between a rabbi and a disciple wasn't just that of a teacher and a student. In fact, the better way of thinking about this is more like a father and a son, in terms of the closeness of the relationship and the nature of the relationship between them. So the idea of father and son is going to crop up as a very useful way of understanding the relationship between them. Disciples didn't just go to listen to a rabbi. They didn't just go to learn what he said. They also went to learn everything about him, what he did, how he did it. They had to observe him in such a way that they could one day do what he does and imitate him. And imitate him both in terms of his conduct, but also his character. When you attached yourself to a teacher of this kind, he was an example to be followed. And that meant that there was a great responsibility on the rabbi to make sure that his life was up to it as well, that the rabbi himself was walking the walk, because those who were with him were going to be watching and imitating and eventually becoming like him. So they were really, these disciples were on a sort of training course in the same way as apprentices were, so that they could one day do exactly what he was like and do what he did. Let's have a look at another passage. Let's look at John 13. And in John 13, we're in the upper room. And we're going to pick it up from verse 13. So John 13, 13. You know about this particular example and this illustration. Jesus is washing the disciples' feet. But we want to pick it up where he's done this. And then he says, do you understand what I've done for you? And from verse 13, would someone like to read out verses 13, 14 and 15, please, from John 13? Someone like to do that for us?
You call me teacher and Lord, and you say well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet, for I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you.
Yeah, now I'm sure we're so familiar with that and we understand it and we know that Jesus has set an example. But this is what a teacher did. He didn't just tell them, go and wash other people's feet. He did it so that then they would copy and they learnt from everything that a rabbi did, even the physical actions. In fact, everything that a rabbi did was designed to teach something to his disciples. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have sort of ordinary conversation as well from time to time, but we don't get to hear that, really. But certainly everything we read in the Gospels, wherever he took them, lots of the things that he did, and that would include the miracles. So, yes, there was lots of times when he just healed out of compassion, but other times he specifically healed or did miracles or, you know, used whatever was around all the time in order to teach. And this is a classic example of him setting an example himself that they would then say, ah. And it wouldn't just be about washing feet. It was what the whole thing would mean in terms of serving and humility and so on. So although that was a very big and you might think unusual thing for Jesus to do, it was actually quite typical in some ways. Let's see this also in Paul's life. If you find 1 Corinthians... So the first letter to the Corinthians, and there's a couple of places. We'll pick it up in chapter 4, 1 Corinthians chapter 4. And it's really verses 15 and 16 that I want. 1 Corinthians 4, 15 and 16. Would someone else like to read those two verses? And then there'll be one more verse to look at in a minute.
Or even if you have 10,000 trainers in connection with the Messiah, you do not have many fathers. For in connection with the Messiah, Yeshua, it was I who became your father by means of the good news. Therefore, I urge you to imitate me.
That's an interesting version, Malcolm. What have you got there?
Complete Jewish.
Okay. Well, we got to the main bit, which is, that's all fine. I urge you to imitate me. But the important thing that he's stressing is I became your father through the gospel. And that, again, was like a rabbi-disciple thing. I mean, it's father-son. And he says, you don't have many fathers. I became your father, presumably because he initially taught them, trained them, and so on. And he says, therefore, I urge you to imitate me, because that's what a rabbi wanted people to do. And the other verse is chapter 11 and verse 1, which is really important to go with this. And I'll read that one, save a bit of time. Chapter 11, verse 1, follow my example as I follow the example of Christ. So because Paul himself was imitating Jesus, then it would be safe to imitate Paul. And Paul is actually saying that Jesus is my rabbi, even though he never, you know, was with him on earth. And although he was never literally a physical disciple of Jesus, he has placed himself like under Jesus in that same way, because he knows that's the only way in which he can effectively then disciple others. And that's another point which I'll come back to in another sort of topic area on this. And do you also remember how Paul often refers to Timothy as Timothy, my son? We won't look those up, but if you look in the early part of both of his letters to Timothy, he uses that expression, which might just be a sort of term of endearment and so on, but it's certainly not a biological thing. But of course, Paul was basically responsible for Timothy in the way of training him up. And eventually, what did Timothy do? He became a big leader on, was it Crete? One of the islands. And that Paul left him there to actually lead the church. And that's what you did as a rabbi. You created disciples who could then go on and lead others in a similar sort of way. So we've seen there the use of the sort of father-son imagery, but also the fact that it was all about imitating and becoming like them so that you could then reproduce what they were doing. Now, to illustrate the next bit, would someone like to look up Mark chapter 2? Mark chapter 2 and verses 23 and 24. Mark 2, 23 and 24. And we'll also have Matthew 15, verse 2. Someone else would like to have that ready. So Mark 2, 23 to 24, and Matthew 15, verse 2. So if someone has got the, can help me out here. Oh, it's back again. Good. Okay, that won't matter too much. Let me just cancel what came up there. So Mark chapter 2, verses 23 to 24, and Matthew 15, verse 2. Someone like to read one of those, please.
Now it happened that he went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and as they went, his disciples began to pluck the heads of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, look, why do they do what is not lawful on the Sabbath?
Thank you. And the other one in Matthew 15, 2.
Why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread.
Right. Now, what's happening here is that Jesus is being challenged, questioned about the behavior of his disciples. Because a rabbi was fully responsible for what his disciples did. After all, he was training them to be like him. So any bad behavior on their part reflected badly on the teacher. And so the Pharisees are actually having a go at Jesus here, like, you're not doing a very good job. Look at what your disciples are doing. But of course, you'll notice that they were challenging them on the matter of the traditions of the elders, the extra laws, not just, you know, not the Torah. So it was about whether or not they could do that on the Sabbath and whether or not they washed their hands and so on. But they were recognizing that in the rabbi-disciple relationship, if the disciples were doing this or not doing this, then that meant that the rabbi wasn't training them up properly. So they were having a go at him for that. So the standard call of follow me, which was used, and which Jesus, as you know, used to call his disciples, was a big life-changing moment. It wasn't just come and learn a few things from me, not just, you know, I'm going to give you a few lessons here and there. It was a total commitment. And if you attached yourself to a rabbi, it was meant to last for years and years. You were sort of starting life anew, and you were starting it with other disciples as well. You know, you became part of a close-knit group with a common life, a common purpose. And in fact, the only way really to be able to go through this process was in the company of others. It wasn't just a one-to-one. It just wouldn't have worked in that sort of way. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus didn't occasionally take just, say, three of his disciples for something, or maybe even just one of them. They didn't all have to be all there all the time. But you were part now of a community, and you were going to be being trained together. And one of the ways we know that it was costly is if you have a look in Luke 18, verse 28, Peter, as part of a bigger passage, but Peter makes a bit of a sort of heartfelt cry, I think, really, in Luke 18, verse 28. What does he actually say?
Peter said, look, we've left our homes and followed you.
Okay, homes. Has anyone got any other words? Was it, I mean, it does include the home.
Left all. We've left all to follow
left
you.
All. Left everything. Everything. Now, you know, when they were called, they left their nets and followed him. Matthew left the tax booth and all the rest of it. But you almost sense here that I don't think Peter's resenting it. But if you read on in the next two verses, Jesus almost had to sort of reassure them, don't worry, it's all worth it in the long run. You don't really lose out. But we will find out in some of the other things that we look at just how costly that was, by leaving absolutely everything. And notice the word follow, whenever it crops up, it's not just a casual, oh, you know, to spend a few days with you, to join you here and there. It meant, always meant, follow in the specific way of discipleship. So it indicated you were open to change. You would accept whatever challenge the master gave you. You would endure whatever hardship was necessary because you trusted the rabbi that this was part of your learning experience. So did everybody want to become a disciple? Did many choose to become a disciple? Well, when you've been through the usual stages of schooling at that point, if you were good enough, you might decide, oh yes, I wouldn't mind going on and I would look for a rabbi to disciple me and train me. And a rabbi might say, okay, come follow me, and off you go. But the rabbi always had the option at any time, if he didn't think this guy was following him properly, was up to it, was taking it seriously, wasn't going to make it, he would be told to go. And he'd be told to go back to your father's house and learn his trade. So that's what would normally have happened. Anyway, when they left school, they would usually start off by following their father's trade. And so they were sent back to their literal father if they weren't up to following their rabbi as their new sort of father. And it's interesting, a bit of speculation really here, but as you know, the first four disciples were all fishing. That was their sort of trade. James and John, their father, was in the fishing business, so they did that, and no doubt, I think Peter and Andrew would have been in the same area and doing the same thing. I nearly said we're in the same boat, but that would have been too much of a pun. But they were all young lads, and that means that they weren't long out of their formal education, if you like. Maybe, this is where the speculation comes in, had they actually already tried to go with another rabbi and been rejected and told, no, go back and be fishermen, or whether they just hadn't thought they were up to it. But it's really crucial to understand that Jesus believed in them. It's crucial for their understanding of what was going to happen, that they felt called. It wasn't a casual thing, okay? And any rabbi, but particularly Jesus in this situation, knew exactly what he was doing by calling them to this new kind of life. He must have seen something either that they didn't see in themselves or that other rabbis didn't. So what was then expected of a disciple? Firstly, he had to memorize all his teacher's words. He had to memorize what was being said in order to be able to repeat them to others. Okay. Now, in those days, of course, you didn't write things down. Well, he said that, you know, you needed a scribe if you were going to get something written down. The only option was oral transmission. So you memorized them verbatim. You were not allowed to say your own thing or to change anything that your teacher has said. So you had to learn it like that, which is one of the reasons why what we have in the Gospels will be very accurate, because they would have memorized everything that Jesus said with the purpose of passing it on. They also had to understand his teaching methods and how he drew meaning from scripture. And as I said, how he lived, walked, and so on. They had to learn everything about their teacher, how he fasted, prayed, recited the blessings, and so on. And in your only priority then in life was to learn how to reflect your rabbi. And if your rabbi did it, then so did you. So let's look at one more passage at this point. That's in Matthew 14. Matthew 14. And we're starting at verse 22. From verse 22 to 33, we're not going to read all this out. Again, it's a well-known bit. The nice thing about these studies is that all the passages you will know. It's just a matter of how well do you know them? What are you going to find out that didn't quite click before? So in Matthew 14, in verses 22 and on to 33, we've got this very powerful drama of Peter walking on the water. And usually we focus on either Peter's courage, who actually getting out the boat, trying, or his failing, because in the end he sunk and he had to be sort of picked up. But we perhaps miss a very important point, is why did Peter even think he could do this in the first place? What's actually going on here? He's out in a boat, during a storm, and before he even thinks about this, well, you tell me, what do you think is going on at this point? Can you work out what I'm getting at? And I want to try and, you know, guess ahead as to what we're saying here.
His master's doing it, therefore he can.
Exactly. Peter would never have thought of getting out the boat and walking on water otherwise. It wasn't, one day I'm going to do this. Well, wouldn't it be nice if? But he sees Jesus doing it. And when he says, if it's you, tell me to come, he fully believes that because Jesus is his rabbi, and Jesus would not call anyone to discipleship if he didn't believe that he was capable, Peter suddenly, and I guess there's a lot of faith involved in all this, is basically saying, my rabbi does it, I should be able to do this. And so to start with, it works. And as you know, in the end, he does sink and Jesus has to rescue him and so on. But remember what I said, everything that a rabbi did, it was aimed to teach. So why was Jesus out there doing this in the middle of the storm? Because he was going to teach them a lesson. And in one sense, Peter succeeded because he showed his commitment as a disciple to his rabbi. And he actually believed enough to be able to say that, you know, you've chosen me, so therefore I believe that I can do what you do. Now you could say, okay, baby steps, he only got so far, and the others hadn't even got as far as that. But it was all based upon the idea of following Jesus's example and learning from him. And as I say, Peter would never have thought that this was anything even worth doing, let alone that he wanted to do, until he saw his rabbi doing it. Right, so that's the first section, really, which is, well, we looked at a lot of scriptures, but it's also sort of background and information on this. We're going to look at something else in a minute, but as usual, anything from you on what you've heard, comments, questions, before we look at another passage. Pat?
I'm just thinking about John and his disciples.
Yeah.
He sent his disciples after Jesus. Now, would that be a normal thing to do?
Ooh, probably not. I think it's based upon the fact that John says, after me is coming one greater, and I'm not worthy, and points and says, you know, he's the Lamb of God. So it's all part of his preparation ministry, really. We're going to look at another time at what it actually means eventually for the disciples to be sent out and to then start to make other disciples, because you'll be aware at the end of Matthew's gospel, that's the point of it all. But I think also John might have understood that he wasn't going to be around forever, and you know, they needed Jesus more than him and things like that. So no, that wouldn't be that normal from what I know. Any other comments or questions? If any of the can help me out.
Helena. I think it just makes me think that we use the word so flippantly and so readily when we speak about discipleship in the church, don't we?
Yeah.
But actually, when you think about it in this kind of vein, there's so much more responsibility, isn't there?
Oh, indeed. And we've only just begun to scratch the surface of this, really.
Yeah.
So you're asking a very big question here, and it's one we could debate all evening and on into other evenings, is to either why we don't do this, or how we might recover something like this, or what does it mean within, you know, the fact that we're not in that first century Jewish culture anyway, so it might have to be adapted a little bit. But you're quite right. We use those words, we can use them easily and flippantly without understanding, and therefore we think we're doing it. It may not be. Malcolm, want to come in?
I was just thinking that it shows Peter's character. He was always impulsive.
Yeah.
So, out he goes, and then he suddenly realises what he's doing.
Well, I you're quite right, and it doesn't surprise us that it was Peter then, does it? And it might almost be that in choosing the disciples that he did, and including Peter, he thought, I bet Peter starts to lead the way in some of these things. You know, I bet he'll start to show others. And of course, Peter was going to have the greatest successes and the greatest failures. And we'll look at some of the things about Peter specifically another time. But you're right. It doesn't surprise me that Peter did this, and probably therefore why Jesus picked him in the first place. John?
Peter was also the oldest of the disciples, because he was the only one along with Jesus who had to pay the temple tax.
That's a good point. Yeah, very interesting. Okay, now that's a little incident we might pick up later. You're quite right there. That's something I've only learnt recently, that, yeah, Peter was the only one. And in fact, Peter was probably the only one that was married. That doesn't necessarily prove anything, because they did usually marry young. But we know that Peter had a wife, which we'll think about another time as well. I used to think, oh, maybe someone like Matthew was quite older because of what the job he was doing and so on. But certainly Peter was the eldest of those four, and probably quite a few of the others. Yeah, yeah.
It's Chris Hill that told us that one.
About the temple tax, good. Yeah. Well, I'm just catching up on little extra snippets like that. You're, there's always more to learn on this. It's great.
Yeah, fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah. And I hope that's going to happen repeatedly through these evenings. Is there anybody else, or shall I move on? Christine?
Anita.
Am I unmuted?
Oh, yeah.
Anita. Okay, yeah, wait, carry on. Just going back to, I can't see because my iPad is frozen. The other lady was saying about how flippantly we use the word disciple. It just makes me think that in the modern church that we have today, we don't, with no disrespect to the pastors of our churches, we don't often actually see that happening in our day-to-day practice. It's, if you like, they get in the way of us being a disciple.
Yeah. It's all part of the system that's, you know, arisen with the church being now an organization and hierarchical structures and putting people in. What we should be doing is getting disciples to disciple others pretty quickly, but we don't. We leave it all to other people. So it's all part of the way the church has become the institution that it has. Okay, let's move on then to a particular passage. I picked this one out to start with. And so it's Luke 9. Again, some of this might be familiar, but I want to sort of squeeze as much out of it as I can. You might have heard that expression about squeezing the lemon, getting every drop out of it. So we're looking at Luke 9 and we're looking at verse 57 onwards. And therefore you can see that this is all about discipleship still. And you've probably got a heading like it's the cost of following Jesus and so on. So Jesus had 12 disciples, but of course he had quite a few other disciples, or was attracting them, hoping to, and so on. Ultimately, of course, he had 120 by the time they got to Pentecost. So following on the fact that we've seen that being a disciple of Jesus was not something to be taken up lightly, and could be therefore very costly, we've got three examples here, which I think Luke has deliberately put together in order to illustrate this. So what I want you to do is to, for the next minute, read through verses 57 to 62. And I'm going to ask you to look for the similarities and the differences. So it's a bit of a sort of structural analysis thing for a minute. Are there any similarities between all three of them? Or are the similarities in pairs? Or what do you notice that's different? It's basically, what do you notice about the structure of the whole thing? So I'll give you a minute to absorb those few verses. That's Luke 9, 57 to 62. So while he's still thinking, Luke has put these three incidents together. You get two of them elsewhere in Matthew's gospel, but not anywhere else. So there's something specific about the way Luke has sort of written this up. I'm not bothered whether they happened on the same day, one after the other or not, probably not. But I think the opening scene is important. They were walking along the road. So all these three incidents happened when they were out and about, and I can assume that the other disciples were there as well. Now, did anyone notice anything in common to all three? It's fairly simple answers I'm looking for here. John, is it?
They were all prepared to, it was all answering a question of, would you follow me?
Yeah. So the word follow, as simple as that, the word follow is in all three, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. There's another word in common to all three. Did anyone spot that? A very short word. Two letters.
Is it go?
It's go, yeah. Okay. Now, if you like doing this sort of study, you can do it again in your own time. And if you want to underline things or write it out and sort of analyse it as well. But that's the first thing, is that there's common words, the words of follow and go. Anything else in common, if not with all of them, at least in some cases? What else did you discover, in other words?
They're all one-to-one conversations with Yeshua.
Yeah, they're all dialogues.
But they're all one-to-one. He's not speaking to a group of them.
Okay, true. Thank you. There is a difference between the three dialogues.
Yeah, I see one is very hot, one is very cold, and one is lukewarm.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. That would make a lot of sense. If they've been put together for a reason, it's so that there are similarities for us to sort of reinforce the message, the point, and I'll come to what the point is at the end. You might think you know what the point of all this is, and you're probably right, but there's a bit more. But the similarity, the differences are also there to add variation and to give us slightly different flavours on all this. But in terms of the conversations, two of them are two statements, but one of them is three. The middle one is different because it's a three-statement dialogue. In other words, the main difference with the middle one is who speaks first. It's Jesus, isn't it? Okay. In the first one and the third one, someone speaks first and Jesus responds. In the middle one, it's Jesus, the man, and then Jesus again. Now, what that suggests is that the first and the third are both volunteering. Okay. The middle one, Jesus is recruiting. He's actually either sought the man out or he's initiated the conversation. The other two have already said to Jesus something along the lines of, I will be your disciple. That's what he's saying with, I will follow you. In the middle one, Jesus himself is initiating it with whatever. The first one offers to follow unconditionally, but Jesus has something important to say to him. The third one may have worked out that it's going to be costly, but he's got a condition attached to it, and Jesus is going to tackle that. And I say the middle one is quite different. See if you can spot the word first in each of these. How many times does the word first appear, or what's the essence of what's going on there? Can you see the word first? Where do these occur?
In verse 59.
So which one is that, the first, second or third guy?
The second.
Second one. Any more? The third one. And effectively, they're saying, first let me. And there's a but. They're sort of either there or implied. Okay. First or but first. Okay. Now, that is not what you do when you're attaching yourself to a rabbi. You don't say, oh, well, first of all, you know, that sort of thing. They might, you think, have got good reasons and so on. But it's a significant thing that they're saying to Jesus, but first. Now, the other thing that's in common to them, oh, Malcolm?
I'm just about to say it, and it's gone out of my mind.
Okay.
They were laying down conditions.
Well, yes. Well, the first one necessarily wasn't, but he hadn't thought it through. But there were conditions on the others, and that's what Jesus is tackling. Remember what we said about discipleship? It's so absolute, so, well, everything, leave everything to follow. You can't have conditions. But the other point is that Jesus replies with three rather enigmatic statements. So this is the first time we're sort of realizing that this is a Jew speaking to Jews, and we need to unpack what they're saying. Some of you may have already sort of met this, but it's very important to understand. So in the first one, where he says, yeah, I'm up for this, I'll follow you, no problems. Wherever you go, I will follow you. And Jesus comes up with this phrase about foxes and birds and so on. And we've usually missed the point completely. And the amount of times I've heard this say, oh, you know, poor old Jesus, everywhere he went, he couldn't find anywhere to sleep. You know, he didn't have a place to lay down his head and so on. And so that's what this is about. And so we interpret it as, if you're going to follow Jesus, it's a tough, rough sort of life. You may end up sleeping in the fields. Oh, Jesus was poor and all the rest of it. Jesus was not poor. He didn't wander around destitute. There's good evidence for that. If you remember that the disciples were supported by some relatively wealthy ladies. We eventually read about that. Well, we read about them in Luke 8. And they had a money bag as well, if you remember. Probably full enough for Judas to be able to dip his hand in and pull something out and think, oh, I bet they won't notice that. So they didn't wander around penniless. So Jesus somehow didn't have anywhere to sleep at night. Just because we might use an expression like that, oh, I'm going to lay my head down and, you know, I'm going to sleep and so on. The first point about that and why this cannot be the case is that in the Middle East then, and I think indeed now, hospitality is so important that you did not let someone wander around without anywhere to stay. And Jesus was popular. He was an esteemed teacher and he was in the Galilee. So everywhere he went, he was welcomed. So we must get out of the thought that somehow this is about Jesus's sort of poverty and destitute and not really having a proper place to sleep. The other clue about this is the illustration he uses. Foxes have holes, birds of the air have nests. Well, why do they? Why do they have holes? Why do birds build nests? Okay, nothing to do with sleeping. Birds don't build nests to go to sleep in. They roost. Birds build nests to lay eggs and to bring up their young until their young are capable enough of flying off for themselves. And foxes sleep in dens, but they dig holes. Why? In order to give birth and then again bring up their young, protecting them until such time as they can go off by themselves. So what's going on here is, and don't forget, this is all about discipleship. I will follow. Jesus is responding as a rabbi would, with using the phrase about laying your head, which is simply meant teaching. It simply meant instructing someone. It was a Hebraic phrase. To lay your head on someone meant obviously to pass on what you know, to transfer your thoughts to someone else's, to instruct them and so on. That's what it meant to lay your head on someone. It meant to teach them, simple as that. Don't do it sleeping, to do it teaching. Now, I've had many students who wished that the whole process of learning was just like having a simple download, as though somehow I could just press a little button and it went zoom and that was it. It's not, it's a prolonged and arduous process, but the whole aim of the rabbi was to lay his head upon the disciples. Why? So that they would think like him, they would know everything he knew, and therefore begin to act in that same sort of way. And the illustrations from nature are the same sort of thing. It's about bringing up your young. It's about bringing up, nurturing the next generation until they are mature enough. So his illustration is exactly the same sort of thing. It's like the father-son illustration. So his whole expression is about him functioning as a rabbi. So why is he actually saying this at this point? And this is where, if we find the equivalent in Matthew, there's a bit of a clue. I didn't tell you whereabouts it was in Matthew. Keep your finger in Luke 9, but turn to Matthew 8. In Matthew 8, verses 18 to 21, Matthew records two of these, and you'll see this one very clearly. But we're told something a bit extra. So see if you can find out what we find in Matthew's gospel, Matthew 8, probably verse 18 or thereabouts, compared to what we've got here. There's an extra tidbit of information which is very useful. What does it tell you about this guy?
Well, he was a scribe.
Oh, you've got scribe there, have you? That's interesting. Okay. You don't have teacher of the law, you have scribe.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't think that matters too much because I said before, thankfully, that it's the same thing. But a lot of you have probably got teacher of the law.
Or a teacher.
So this was a guy who was already used to the teaching thing. So what was he expecting? What did the teachers of the law normally do? Well, they held classes. They had places where they laid their head. Like, we've got a place. It's on Zoom. It's virtual. But you know that on Thursdays between 7 and 8.30, I'm going to try and lay my head upon you, so to speak. And Jesus' point here is that if you are going to come and be my disciple, I don't give classes. I don't just do a couple of hours here and there. I haven't got anywhere where you turn up and you learn. You've got to be with me 24/7. You said, I will follow you wherever you go. Did you really mean that? Because I don't have anywhere where suddenly I do it. You will learn from me all the time as we go along. That's what true discipling is. Was he prepared for that? That's the question that Jesus is firing back at him in response to, I will follow you. Okay? Don't expect that you can sort of sign up to a course of some kind and that will do the trick. I don't teach like that. I think also the phrase is useful in that the whole idea of a rabbi teaching the disciple is that the rabbi becomes the head effectively, and the head is, you know, functional, it controls the rest of the body and so on. So it is about allowing the teacher to basically control the way you're going to think and act from now on. So that's why a teacher is always looking to lay their heads and so on people, so that they become like them. And then in the next one, remember, this is the one where Jesus picks up on someone, follow me. And the man comes up with this interesting request, and Jesus follows it up with something even more enigmatic. Again, you may have heard this explained before. It's quite common. But the problem that people have with this, and one of the reasons for sharing this with you, is that, go on, you can then you pass this on to others, you know, and you do what this is all about. When someone else, you know, says incorrectly what's going on here, you now know how to put it into their heads as well. First, let me go and bury my father. Gives the impression that, oh, poor chap, he's just lost his father. And Jesus is being very mean here because he's not allowing him to do that. You know, you can't do this first. But this doesn't in any way mean that the guy just lost his father. In fact, it's highly unlikely, because in those days, if you just lost someone like that, you wouldn't be out on the road. You'd be at home mourning the 7-day period of Shiva, where you sit at home and people come and pay their respects. The phrase to bury my father was simply an idiom again, which meant basically, well, I've got to stay at home. I've got to do my family duty. And when my father is eventually died and he's buried, then I'll be free to come and follow you. This is a huge excuse. This is a delaying tactic. And everybody that heard him say this would understand that that's what the guy was actually saying. So, yeah, I like the idea of following you, but, you know, family comes first. I'm going to go and wait until the time has come. And then when my family duties are over, then I'll be free. And Jesus is having none of that. And I think basically when he says, let the dead bury their own dead, he's sort of repeating the idea back. And the dead would be those who have no interest in following Jesus, not interested in the kingdom. So, no, let them do that sort of thing. Let those who are not going to be following me do all that sort of thing. But you have got to be different. And in fact, he says, but you, and it's very emphatic in the Greek. It's almost like repeating it. But you go and proclaim the kingdom. Okay, so he spotted the excuse and so on. And he's saying, you can't put that first. Again, we'll look again at all the understandings about how you need to put Jesus first. The phrase about burying your father is, I think it's still in use. It might be asked of anybody who had plans that might involve moving away from the family. And someone might say, aren't you going to bury your father first? Which doesn't mean, aren't you going to go and dig a big hole and put him in it? It actually meant, aren't you going to wait until, and then you can leave, and so on. So it was an idiom that Jesus was using there. And the third one, which we'll come to now, and then I'll ask for any comments, but I'll just carry on with the third one. He also has a but first. And again, it seems very reasonable. Yeah, I'll follow you, but I've got to go back and say goodbye to my family. I've got to go and say, that's it, and so on. And if you remember, in the Old Testament, this did happen one occasion when Elisha asked permission to go back to his family, and they burnt the ploughs and they had a final meal and so on. So why does Jesus seem to be taking a bit of a hard line here? And that's because we don't quite understand, again, what's going on with the let me go back and say goodbye. Because the phrase that's used, and that's even in the Greek as well, as the Hebrew behind it, it's not the way we might think. I go back and say, right, I'm off, goodbye, that's it. You had to go and take leave of your family. You had to go and ask permission to go off and do something, particularly as radical as this. Okay, you didn't make your own decisions on this. So it's really saying, I better go and find out if my family are happy for me to do this. And then if they said yes, then they say, like, goodbye to their son, in this case, as in God be with you, or, that's what we mean by it. So what he's really saying is, well, I'd like to follow you, but, my parents may not really want me to, so I better go and ask them. And you probably almost feel in the back of his mind he's thinking, they won't let me, so I can be all keen, I can show how much I want to follow Jesus, but actually I've got a get-out clause here. So just let me go back and check it's okay. And, Jesus said, basically, if you put your hand to the plough and look back, you're not fit for service. And actually, there was another similarity. I didn't perhaps give you long enough to find some of these. But in both the second and the third case, Jesus ends what he says in the same way. So what do you think that is now? In the second and the third case, Jesus ends what he says with the same phrase, which is what?
Kingdom of God.
The kingdom of God. And in both cases, they're making excuses based upon their family and their home. And I think Jesus here is making a deliberate sort of contrast between the life that they know, their upbringing and so on, and actually their duty, responsibility, or their desire to become part of the kingdom of God. And then he gives another illustration about the plough. And there's nothing that sort of enigmatic about that. It's just typical of the time. But I'll just briefly explain it. He talks about someone who puts his hand to the plough. And what's interesting there is it is hand, not hands. So it is singular for a reason, because that's what you did. You simply used one hand on the plough, which was a fairly sort of light thing. but you guided the plough with one hand, usually your left hand, and you had to keep the plough upright. You had to keep it the right pressure. If there's any stones in the way, you had to make sure you lifted it over that. The other hand was used to goad the oxen. You had your goad, your stick with a spike on it. And at the same time as being able to handle this and handle that, you had to look very firmly, put it like this, between the hind quarters of the two oxen. You had to keep your eyes looking ahead. In other words, ploughing required a lot of dexterity and a lot of concentration. And to look round would be disastrous. Any distractions, you might break the plough, you might cut into a furrow that had already been done as you went off track, you might go into a part of the field that was going to be ploughed next to it, so you went off track that way. In other words, you could destroy the rest of the work. And Jesus is really giving this illustration to say that in the service of the kingdom, anything other than complete dedication and focus might not only be unproductive, it might be destructive. So you can't have a but first. Okay, you've got to be that fully committed. So in each of these cases, whether they were keen or just sort of slightly interested, Jesus offers them a bit of a challenge to think about. Now, I've got two more points to make out of that, but I'll pause now. I've gone on for quite a while and give you a chance to respond to that, either in terms of what I've said or other questions or comments. And then I'll wrap this session up with a couple of other points which come out of this passage. So, Jan, is it next? Yeah.
Being a pain, but isn't Jesus asking the man to, when he says, let he wants to go and bury his father.
Yeah.
And Jesus basically says, not if you're following me, you don't. But then if he follows Jesus, he's breaking the fifth commandment, honor your parents, look after them.
Yeah, okay.
I've just read Steve's book.
No, you want your pain. No, I'm going to talk more about the family clash, if you like, between following Jesus and your family. I suppose you could say there must be still a way of honouring them. But it does raise an interesting question, which I'll pose now, is that it's all very well for these young guys to go off following Jesus, but what did their family actually think about it? I mean, were they happy with that? Or might they not have been? So you could still honour them, even though you're not necessarily doing everything that they might have expected. Okay, I mean, you could stay at home and dishonor them in that sense. Mm-hmm. I suppose you're asking a good question on the lines of what does it really mean, that commandment then? And how does it, like all these sort of things, what happens when another commandment, in this case to follow Jesus, seems to clash with it? How do you resolve that sort of thing? So I don't think Jesus is saying, it's not important or you're not going to honor them. But we're going to see time and again, he always puts himself first in front of every other situation. And that would include this. But you're right, it still seems a bit harsh. Yeah, John?
Just thinking, wouldn't it have been classed as a great honour for anyone to be chosen to follow a rabbi?
Well, yes. And indeed, particularly Jesus at this point, where he's already very well established, he's chosen his 12. So you would hope that either the family would be happy with that, and indeed, if they did go back and say, oh, can I please leave? They would say, yeah, great, shalom, off you go. Goodbye. Not as in, reluctance or whatever, but with my blessing. So yes, it would be an honour. And don't forget, that one was the chap where Jesus had approached him. So Jesus had picked him out as someone. I mean, you could say Jesus always knew what their responses were going to be. But yeah, that's right. Anybody else on it? Malcolm again?
Doesn't this show the fact that our following serving in the kingdom of God, following Jesus, has got to be absolutely central in our lives above all other things.
Yeah. And it does raise the question then, how does that marry in with what we think of as other responsibilities towards our family, for instance? And we're going to look at that in the other passages, because there's another for next week. The two sessions I'm doing, the two halves of it, the second one is still coming back to these sort of issues. So, Pat?
Actually, it's probably better for next week, because I'm thinking of the mother of Zebedee.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, well, that's an example of an overambitious mother, I think. Do you mean the mother of James and John, and saying, can we have top slot? Yeah. But there's lots of other family issues that revolve around this whole discipleship thing. Do we have any other hands at this point? Okay, you'll have a chance again at the very end, but let me ask the final two questions and points about this. We've got these three young men. We assume they're fairly young. We know one of them is a teacher of the law. In each case, the man is not named. His identity remains unknown. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we're not told, like?
Because they didn't follow him.
We'll come to that point in a minute. But I can take what you're saying there. If they didn't, it's probably best not to name and shame. But there's the more important reason as to why they're not named.
Because they're unimportant.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Is each one multiple people?
Oh, that's an interesting point. Yes, go on. I like that. It's not quite what I'm going to say, but it certainly fits in with it. Any other ideas? John? Yes,
with the person who just spoke, I think because it's meant for everyone.
Yeah, and therefore, in particular, it's meant for...
us.
You. Okay?
Yeah.
You put yourself in this situation. Every time there is someone, a certain man or whatever, you think, I've got to put myself into that position. So you're right, it is everyone, but don't hide behind that sort of crowd scene. It is you, because that's the whole point of them being recorded. What would you do in these three situations? Are these excuses ones that you make or likely to make? What puts you off from following Jesus fully? And the other thing about them all is they've all ended with Jesus saying something, and in each case, we don't get a response from the man. Okay? We're left to finish the stories ourselves, which is very typical of the way that Jesus would teach and very typical of the way the gospel accounts include these stories. It's left for us to say, what would we now say if we heard Jesus talking like that to us? And the second thing follows on from what someone has just said. You've made an assumption that in each case they didn't follow Jesus. Why do you think that? Because actually we're not told. Again, it's left open. I can't say for sure that each of them then walked away and decided, okay, that's it, I'm not doing it. They may have heard what Jesus said, and they may have rethought, and they may, if not immediately, come back another time and said, yeah, I've understood this now. I really do want to follow you. So we don't condemn them. We might want to read it as though, oh, no, they left and they didn't come back and all the rest of it. But the stories are left unsuspended. They're left suspended, not only so that we can put ourselves into them, but actually... we don't know. We shouldn't judge these guys as, no, in the end, they didn't bother. And there's one other situation where the same sort of thing happens. We'll look at Matthew 19 to finish with. It's in all the Gospels, but we'll find Matthew 19, verses 16 to 22. So Matthew 19, verses 16 to 22, it's the story that we call the rich young man. We don't learn till later on that he's actually rich, But just to pick out what I'm saying here, there's a lot more in this particular story. But we've got another young man, unnamed. Why? Because it might be you. Okay, comes to Jesus. They go through a conversation. Jesus ends with something specific that he has to do and then says, come, follow me. Remember, follow me always means become a disciple in the way that we've been talking about. And then in verse 22, he goes away sad because he had great wealth. And about every time you've looked at this or heard someone teaching it, it's, oh, he went away and he never followed Jesus. It doesn't say that. We don't know what he did. Yes, he went away sad, but did he rethink at some point? Did this stick with him? Did he eventually do what Jesus said and come back and say, I've done that. Can I now be your disciple? Again, the story is left open so that we can put ourselves into it and make our own decisions on this. And in fact, he may well have gone away sad because he knew he was going to give it all away. I mean, that might have made him sad. but we can't always assume what we often, you know, might have first thought or what we've been told, that no, he gave up, he never bothered. He might not have done, but he might have done. All we know is he went away sad because of what he had great possessions, and therefore he was left with the challenge. That might have been enough to make him sad, but he might have responded, he might have come back the next day or later and actually said, I'm now going to follow you, I've actually done this. And that would be the case if you put yourself in that story. You might go away thinking, oh no, I'm not going to do this and all the rest of it. But of course you might change your mind. That's always open to do that. So that's how these stories work. They work with anonymity so that we can put ourselves in them. And they're left open-ended, suspended, so that actually, you never know, they might become disciples in the end. So, yeah, Malcolm?
Betty had a point.
Okay, yeah, we'll go for questions now. Whatever order, Christine, who do you want?
Betty first.
Yeah.
Well, it's not a question, Paul. I'm just so thankful you said that because I was thinking through these. Well, I mean, I made a promise years ago to follow Jesus, but I didn't understand the implications.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, yes, I'd assumed that they weren't able to follow him. And you think, oh, gosh, I really blew it right at the beginning because I didn't know what I was letting myself in for, really. Mm.
Well, if this is their first encounter with Jesus, that might have all been a bit of a shock. And they may have just had time to process it and rethink. The stories are there to teach us that this is the excuses that we come up with. This is, you know, the challenges. And then it's up to us how to finish the story. Mm. And we don't know what they did.
Mm, thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Malcolm next, then Judith Clementson.
I was just thinking that he may have been sad because he couldn't follow Jesus straight away, that he had to do something else before he could follow.
Yeah, yeah. I don't see any problem with him being sad, given the circumstances. It's whether he remains sad, if you like. So, there's no problem with him being saddened by that.
Judith?
I was just thinking as you were talking about it, I felt quite lifted by the fact that we don't know what happened to them all, but at no point do we believe that Jesus turned on his heels and walked away. So we've always got that chance.
Yeah.
And I think that because it's open like that, you always feel, if I don't make the decision, Jesus will still welcome me.
Exactly. You've got time to think it through and so on. And this is part of what I'm trying to get across. It's not just explaining the words and how they might mean something different from what you might originally have thought, or but you might have had this teaching before, but actually it's to put us in the story. This is the Hebraic nature of the Gospels at work here, because it's all about, largely about anyway, about discipleship and responses to it. And that's why we felt we've had to start with this aspect of it. But it gets you into the feel of how these stories work, if you like, how the texts work, because you're going to meet similar sort of things from time to time.
Yes. Caroline and then Pat.
Oh, no, sorry, I was unmuted. Sorry, I was going to answer the question before, but someone else did. Sorry.
Hey, Pat.
It's just a logistics question. When you're talking about Jesus saying he'd know where to lay his head, and you said, well, that doesn't mean he'd know where to go because they're very sociable and hospitable.
But does that mean...
Does that mean that it would be accommodation for him and everybody else that was following him?
Ah, well, that's a very good point, isn't it? Because, yeah, you know, did they ever go home themselves? I suppose it would to some extent. I mean, I always think about, even in, back in Jerusalem, Jesus was always welcomed at Mary, Martha and Lazarus's place in Bethany. That's where he stayed overnight there. But where the other disciples went to, and I'm not saying, they never did sleep out under a starry sky sort of thing. The climate was probably okay for that. But the impression that's sort of painted about this, well, firstly, you've got to understand what it does mean. otherwise, you miss the whole point of it. But Jesus would have been welcomed in all sorts of places. And certainly when he was around the Galilee, around Capernaum and so on. And obviously he probably didn't have his own home as such, but I suppose his mother still had a place. But yeah, you're quite right. What happened to all the other disciples? Would they be welcomed just as much? Did they sometimes go back to their own homes? Just because you were following a rabbi all the time, I don't think it meant that you literally were there every minute of every time. And that's why some of the disciples aren't there from time to time. But you'd given up your, you didn't have your job anymore. You had different commitments. So you had to be prepared to go wherever, get in a boat, cross the lake. Okay. Why do I want to go there? I don't, but I'm going because Jesus is saying so. So, yeah. You know, in other words, you may have had to sleep rough from time to time with Jesus, but that's not the main point of it.
I think most houses had a central courtyard.
Yeah.
Where they and it wasn't a question of whoever was offering the hospitality had to offer half a dozen bedrooms. They had bedrolls with them, so it was a very simple existence, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they would be used to that sort of thing anyway. Quite possibly, you know, it wasn't as though they all had luxurious houses and so on. But yeah, you're quite right. They may have had to sort of kip down even in the stables outside or somewhere nearby. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Anita? She's frozen.
She's frozen, actually, yeah. So, oh, there she is.
Unmute yourself. Oh, it won't work again.
Okay, is there anyone else in the meantime?
Not that I can see.
Okay. We'll just wait another bit here for Anita.
Monica.
She has problems sometimes.
Okay. Are you saying there's someone else?
Well, Monica is waving her hand.
Oh, okay. Is she? Where is she?
Hiya, I'm just here.
There you are. Hi.
I just wanted to contrast the instances where Jesus has spoken to these people, contrast it with the parables that he talks about in Matthew,
yeah.
Which are more positive, obviously. It's the kingdom of heaven is like treasure hidden in a field.
Yeah.
And found it, he hid it again, and then in his joy went and sold all that he had. And again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant looking for fine pearls. When he found one of great value, he went away and sold everything that he had and bought it. So that's the flip side of those stories where someone is full of joy,
yeah,
and sells everything.
Well, okay. And we will look at what he taught in parables at some point. I think what you're saying there is, well, what I would have said was that... that isn't necessarily a particular man. It's just an expression that Jesus was talking about. You know, It's not like, oh, this man went and did that.
No.
But I take the point. It's like when the disciples said, we've left everything to follow you. And Jesus said, oh, look, it's all worth it. You're going to get back whatever. You know, the kingdom of heaven is worth it. Whatever you've given up, you get more by being part of the kingdom of heaven. So, yeah, those parables reinforce that particular message. But there's a lot more to dig into with the parables eventually. So, Anita, are you with us now?
Yes. Okay, I'm unmuted. The bit where we were talking about honouring your father and mother, how it might go against that, I was just thinking about Matthew 12 in verse 48, 49, when at the time when Jesus was teaching, everybody was asking, you know, here's your mother and father. And he said, well, looking at the disciples, here's my mother and father. I think that he gives a very interesting aspect of who your mother and father is. And to me, it says that actually the kingdom of God and serving God is more important than anything else.
Thank you. That's a perfect advert for next time when we cover that bit and other similar ones as we look at sort of family issues later. So to round up, next time, the first bit I'm going to talk about is authority. What did it mean for Jesus to teach with authority? And then we'll look at more of these sort of discipleship issues. So we're looking at Jesus as rabbi with authority. What did that mean? And then particularly some of these rather tricky things of how do you go about being a disciple when you have got family or other things like that? So those are the two main things for next time. And so that's when we pick things up again. So shall we stop the recording now then, please?